the latest episode of the podcast sees me talking about stuff with Mike Shaw Nye, who is Registrar and Secretary at the University of Exeter. We talk about Mike's role at the university and his title, which now has something of a classic feel to it, but means that it requires some explanation, particularly to those not familiar with the university administration. We also learn that he has rather a good registrarial gown. After graduation, Mike worked for both Majestic Wine and Wetherspoons before joining the HE sector, having decided he needed to do something a bit more worthwhile. Stints at Liverpool, Manchester and Queen Mary universities followed before he joined Exeter some 7 years ago. Interestingly, Mike encountered Tim Martin, founder of Wetherspoons, at a Brexit debate on campus some while ago, and Martin picked him out despite his having left the organisation many years before and asked him how he's getting on. Mike described some of the strengths of Exeter and its recent strategy development and resulting organisational realignment in support of delivery of agreed strategic themes, drawing on a rugby analogy to make the point well. Looking to the future, Mike sees big challenges ahead in terms of finances, industrial action and the expectations placed on universities, and stresses the need for institutions to project ourselves better. Finally, he notes with pleasure the value in joining graduation ceremonies and observes that the tone and atmosphere of different ceremonies is often aligned to the subject matter, for example, slightly staid law versus exuberant drama, suggesting perhaps a future university parlour game of guess the discipline from graduation video footage. Anyway, it's a good conversation, and I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time, it's my huge pleasure to introduce Mike Shaw Nye, who is Registrar and Secretary at the University of Exeter. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you.
It's great to have you on. Now, just the title first, if we can, because there aren't many registrars. There's even fewer registrars with just the registrar title. But registrar and secretary is the classical configuration of the title. How do you feel about you know, being a classic registrar and secretary?
It's a good question. Prior to coming to Exeter 7 years ago, I was chief operating officer at Queen Mary. I have to say the title was different, but the role was pretty similar. I think it works in the university setting, particularly in Exeter, where, you know, if people say registrar with quite a degree of expectation and there's a real weight of history to it, where it kind of falls down a bit is the moment you go outside of the curtilage of the university and people have no clue. So they often ask me, you know, is it difficult remembering all of the students' names, and am I a medic? Because, of course, yeah, that's the kind of the comparison over there. But within the university, it does work. I do quite like explaining it when we have dinners and guests coming to the university, the kind of two elements of the role in terms of supporting the governing body and the chair, and then also supporting the vice chancellor and the executive. So I don't really think there's a comparable role really anywhere in the rest of the economy, to be perfectly honest. And certainly when people join the university, they're often quite bemused by that kind of the kind of split nature of the role.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I must admit, I do prefer the traditional, I mean, I'm biased as well, but do prefer the traditional title to the, you know, the fancy pants COO stuff.
One of my favourite bits of the job is we have a registrar gown. So I only have a lowly bachelor's degree, which I just about scraped in honours. But obviously, all of my colleagues have got PhDs. So in other universities, when I was stood in graduation queues, I always looked rather, you know, rather low rent on the intellectual front. But the registrar's gown looks like a PhD gown and hat. So it's rather good. It's sort of it's writing intellectual checks that I can't really cash. But the other element of it, which I quite like, is when I started, they said there's a green strip of a felt that runs around the edge of the strip, and they said this is actually the original gown. And I said, really? I said, yes, from 1955 when the university was set up. They said, admittedly, the sort of main material of the gown was replaced in the mid 1970s because it was eaten by moths, and then the felt got a bit worn away, so we replaced that 5 years ago. So I sort of left it hanging, really, in the fact that it wasn't exactly the original gown. However, the spirit was still there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, my official registrar gown at Nottingham is
It's very dark and dull, and has a tiny bit of gold and a bit of green on it. And so despite my PhD, of course, I look quite low key.
Oh, so
Whereas,
you're dumbing down, and
yeah,
oh well,
reaching up, yes,
reaching up, yes, aspiring, aspiring, yeah.
you don't hear me complaining about it much.
No, yes.
So, but. Mike, so you've been at Exeter 7 years, Queen Mary before that, but you didn't start off working in university administration and management, did you? You started
No.
off in a slightly more liquid environment.
Yes, yeah, I kind of I sailed through my university degree, and obviously one of the main things you're meant to do is think about what you want to do next, which I utterly failed to do, which makes me feel slightly hypocritical overseeing career services. But anyway, I finished my degree, wanted to go to London where all my friends were, and thought, what do I like? And I'd been in the university wine society, and I thought, well, I know I'll join the wine trade. That should be quite good fun. So I joined Majestic Wine as a graduate trainee, which kind of translated to be driving the van around South London and delivering lots of cases and unloading lorries and things. But I have to say, I really enjoyed it. We were supported to do kind of wine and spirit education trust examinations and certificates. I got to go and make wine in Bordeaux and Champagne. I ended up being a regional manager for the north of England and Scotland and opened about 10 shops. I had about a group of about 20 incredibly dedicated people, not dissimilar actually to university administrative staff, in that everybody's got that real passion for what they do. I did that for about 8 9 years, and I wanted to go and run. There were some operations opening up in France, and I didn't get that, so I flounced out, Paul. I flounced out in 2000, just after the millennium. We'd had this extraordinary year, and I joined JD Wetherspoons, which was the pub group, which was quite a shock. So the my last night at Majestic, they took me out to a restaurant called Christopher's in Wandsworth, which is a very flash place, and they took along kind of some of the finest wines the Majestic had. So we finished off with a glass of Château Yquem, which is at the time was about 1400 quid a bottle. It's I'm not sure what it would be now. So each glass was about 200 quid, and it was
Blimey.
marvelous. It was absolutely delicious. The next day I went to the Weather Centre, which is the Wetherspoons head office, and and at the end of the night we went out to Wetherspoons in town, and I was given a bottle of Blue Wicked, and I remember thinking, gosh, this, I'm not in Kansas anymore. However, the thing with Wetherspoons is it's absolutely extraordinary at what it does in terms of its purity of focus. Literally everything is focused on giving a great customer experience and delivering that kind of good value that and you expect. So I worked as a regional manager, and then for a while I was a kind of like a mini managing director of a group of late night operations called Lloyd's Number One. So that was great, kind of choosing music
Yeah.
and that kind of thing. And then I think I was probably about 31, 32. My son was born. I found myself in I think it was Milton Keynes at about 3 o'clock in the morning in a nightclub, thinking, what on earth am I doing? All of my family are kind of doctors and teachers, police officers, and kind of there's quite a kind of civic call. So I thought, well, I need to do something that's a bit more giving something back. And I joined a recruitment agency that specialised in charities. I thought I'd end up working in a kind of I always fancied working for National Trust or someone like that. And someone said, well, we don't have any of that, but we do have a job, director of residential commercial services, the University of Liverpool. It was kind of changes to tuition fees. They wanted more of a customer focus. Could you do it? So I joined, and yeah, it was great. It was a bit like shooting fish in a barrel from a kind of commercial point of view, because I'd been
Yeah.
used to a really hardcore commercial environment. I remember at my first year, I'd kind of transformed the financial performance of my division, and did a fantastic job. And the VC called me in and said, well, you've had a bad year, haven't you? And I said, well, what do you mean? I've doubled my surplus. And he said, yes, but I can't see anybody's happier as a result of you being part of this. I can't see students thinking that the services are better. And so that was a really salutary. I kind of learned that the KPIs in HE are, there's a multiplicity, aren't there? And there's so many things you need to do, which is much more complex than in that purely, red and tooth and nail kind of commercial world. And from there, really, I was very lucky to work with some extraordinary people, and I was supported and mentored by a couple of pretty famous registrars from history, people like Albert McMenemy and Will Spinks. The VC of Manchester, who's still the VC of Manchester, Nancy Rothwell, put me forward for the Aspiring Registrars program, which was ran by HUA, our august body. And yeah, the rest was history, really. So after I went for Liverpool, I went to Manchester, and then my first COO job down in QM. So yeah, so an interesting route. I'd like to say it was planned. It wasn't in any way. I suppose the decision to join the wine trade because it sounded like fun was a decision, and then the decision to try and do something that I felt was going to kind of add to, you know, add to society and give something back led me to join universities. I didn't really know that there was a role for someone like me in there, but I have to say it's been extraordinary.
So that, I mean, you know, it's really interesting how you come in through the kind of commercial side of things as well. So are there any plans to open the Wetherspoons on the Exodus campus?
Well,
Hull have got one.
Yeah, no, I mean, actually, the one of the at the bottom of the campus in Exeter, obviously we've got campuses in Cornwall too, but the one next to our Stretton campus is one of the biggest and finest of the Wetherspoons, which is called the Imperial, which is really treated a bit like the university common room. And it was one of the first Wetherspoons pubs that they opened. And Tim Martin, who's the chairman, actually is from this neck of the woods and lives around here. The last time I saw him, actually, he was memorably he came onto campus to do a debate with Professor Steve Smith on the merits or otherwise of Brexit. Obviously, Professor Sir Steve was arguing to remain, and Tim Martin obviously was famously arguing to leave. But at the and I was supporting Steve with a variety of kind of briefings and that kind of thing, and sat in the front of the lecture theatre. And at the end of the session, as Tim walked out, he walked over to me and said, "Oh, it's good to see you. You were a regretted departure," and shook my hand. And it was probably, well, at the time, it was probably 16, 17 years since I'd gone, which I thought was, either he's incredibly well briefed, I've got an extraordinarily distinctive and quite unpleasant face that he could have picked out from all of those years, or, you know, yeah, I must have had an impact there. But yeah, interesting.
No, I mean, it could have been any of those things, of course. but there are people who, and some people who reach very senior leadership positions who do have that ability to remember faces and names, which when I've encountered them, I've always found utterly extraordinary. My first ever job, which was at Staffordshire Poly, the director there was Keith Thompson, who'd been there for many, many years when it was local authority run. But he was one of those people. He was a very charming and, you know, delightful man, but he was one of those people who remembered absolutely everyone he came across. And of course, as a leader in the university environment, it's an absolute gift, because it means that whoever you encounter anywhere on the campus, you know who they are, and you're able to say, "Hello, Dave. Hello, Susan. How's it going?" You know, and I just think that's extraordinary. It's a wonderful talent to have, if indeed it was true in his case.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly find that you know, one of the jobs of the senior leaders is to make people understand and make live how their contribution actually matters beyond what it is that they're doing. And I do try and do that with everyone, because even the smallest of things can really make a huge difference. And, you know, so on the face of it, a colleague doing a job which would lead them to be doing that, you know, maybe you wouldn't take them as seriously, but actually they are beyond serious. You know, I always remember turning up at a university that will remain nameless, and somebody was managing the kind of car parking barrier, and I sort of drove up to it, and they said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm here to see." And I said, "Well, I don't know who that is. You're gonna have to think again and reverse." And I remember thinking, gosh, well, my only engagement with this august organization is through that particular individual and at that point. So how can you get everyone to understand the role they can take and the way they can make a difference? I mean, I certainly found during reflecting on that during COVID, you know, the sort of unsung heroes that came out across the institution were extraordinary. At one stage, we were looking after about 5,000 students who were self-isolating. And so kind of cleaning staff, portering staff, people from the grounds team were literally running around delivering food and stuff, you know, whilst the rest of the country were really hiding in their homes, you know, trying not to do anything and look after themselves, you know. And you think, well, that kind of quiet heroism. But they saw how important it was. They cared about their students and the fact they were away from home and they were not feeling well. And they knew that there was nobody else that was going to do it. So, yeah, and so celebrating that, celebrating the small contributions that add up to the big contribution, I think, is a key part of what we do.
Yeah. So in terms of Exeter as an institution, I mean, you know, it's you know, really grown and risen to prominence in the past 15 years or so. I mean, how do you articulate it then to, you know, to people who don't know Exeter terribly well as a university? What's your, you know, your elevator pitch on you've covered the registrar thing over dinner, right? But how do you cover the rest of the university when people ask you about that?
I think we still feel like a challenger. You know, we still feel like a new kid on the block. We feel like we are still striving, that we're really focused, and you know, we have a real hunger to do better all the time. You know, one example I think is that our leadership team, we finally turned the corner and did a really good job in the NSS last year after 4 or 5 years of really struggling with it. Did we celebrate 25 seconds? Did we then spend the next hour talking about how we could do even better? You know, and it's that kind of sense of disquiet and wanting to push on. The institution is very proud of its regional roots. It's an important contributor to the cultural, economic, educational life of Cornwall and Devon. You know, just the numbers alone, I think it's around 1.5 billion of GVA across the two counties. You know, about I think it's like 2 or 3% of the jobs in Cornwall are working for the university. So the things that we do and the convening power we can bring can really transform lives here, and we take that very seriously. You know, our senior team are encouraged to engage. I sit on a theatre board. I sit on a multi-academy trust board, involved with a science park. You know, our civic mission is really important. At the same time, we've been looking over the last decade really to go beyond that and to look for our kind of global reach. And so we are looking to obviously both bring international staff and students to the Southwest, but also to go out to engage. Obviously, we're not at the level that you are in Nottingham in terms of your kind of your feet on the ground. Mm. But that kind of commitment to future partnerships is key. We've always been proud of our research base, but I think it probably 15 years ago had maybe a higher reputation than it potentially deserved in terms of scale and breadth. And that absolute focus on research power was really Steve Smith, the former VC's absolute focus. And you know, if you see the performance, I don't think anyone else in the sector has seen the same level of growth of research power in terms of numbers of academic staff, researchers and quality over two ref cycles as anyone else in the sector. And obviously we are focused on maintaining that and delivering it. But one of the things I love, the new VC, Lisa Roberts, undertook a kind of, I suppose, I don't want to describe it as a crowdsourcing, but it's basically a kind of an engagement process across the university, a big conversation about what our new strategy would be. And there were something like 4,000 written submissions to it. It was absolutely extraordinary. I've never seen so many people get engaged. And what came out from that was the goal of the university, all of the staff, all of the students, all the alumni, all of this wanted the university to have a difference in the world. And it came up with this kind of three areas of focus. So to make the world healthier, you know, kind of particularly the focus on dealing with aging, greener and more sustainable, so finding ways to tackle climate change, and fairer. And we've just been through a process over the past year and a half of effectively creating three faculties from our six colleges with a focus of each of them on one of those three areas. So we've taken that kind of principle of focus and turned it into an organisational reality to help deliver it. So you've got that combination of an entire community wanting to make a difference and then us trying to enable it and support it. So I think we are, you know, we're not as agile as a brand new startup tech company, but I think we're a damn sight more agile than much of the rest of the sector. Mm. I think when we set our mind to do something, then we absolutely go for it. I've got this analogy which I've always kind of used in my working life, and it goes back to when I was I used to be a prop in rugby, which is basically one of the sort of slightly chunky lads that stand in the front or lasses and basically get battered.
Loose head or tight head?
I was a loose head. Yeah, I couldn't cope with tight head because it used to when it collapsed I never liked it. But the one thing I learned really with that is if you want to achieve something, the more you can bring together people, the more overwhelming power you can bring to bear on a situation, the more success you can have. So, you know, if it's one or two of you in an institution leaning in on something, you'll make a slight difference. If it's everybody, you know, it's you can literally move mountains. So So I think that's the kind of organization we are. I think we've been running very hot for a long time. I think expectations are high. I think we are getting better at dealing with kind of listening to staff and staff considerations and staff well-being. But that is also a sort of key focus, I think, for the future. And also just looking really to make sure that we kind of are as diverse and inclusive as we can be, you know, because of our geographic location and because of our history. It's an honor really to be part of the university. It's one of those places that I think just is going to keep going from strength to strength.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting to hear. Going back to the reorganization into faculties then. So does that kind of break traditional disciplinary boundaries then, if it's thematic according to those fairer, greener, I've forgotten what the first one was, healthier?
Yeah. So one of its core goals was to enhance interdisciplinarity, and also just to see where we could create interesting synergies. So one of the interesting ones in the greener area, we brought the business school together with elements of our engineering facilities and teams. So we've got a really powerful group within the business school who focus on the circular economy, which is really where you design kind of the development of products and their utilization and bringing them through as a way of minimizing waste. We've also got within our engineering teams a renewable energy capacity. We've also got big data teams who work with the Met Office. So you start to put those groups together and you suddenly start to get insights and the ability to solve problems which are really, really complex and really difficult and at a systematic level. And it's talking very much as well to sort of future educational programs. You know, we've got a strand in our business school which is focused around kind of green futures, and the students as part of their work do a project with an SME on, you know, how can they help tackle their carbon, their net zero journey, you know. So I really genuinely think it's going to work. It obviously has, you know, slightly more prosaic benefits in terms of it creates really strategic units that can deal with whatever happens in a particular intake year. And that's, I think, particularly important in the humanities, social sciences areas. It allows us to also put additional investment into departments. So one of our challenges was we'd had a structure that was in place for 15 years, 6 colleges, minimal support for departments, all the work being done at colleges. When that was put in place, we had 14,000 students. When we made the change, we had 31,000 students. So the colleges really were too big to be tactical, too small to be strategic. And what this allowed us to do was to really address that, and also to put some investment into our kind of heads of department, but also put alongside them a head of professional service in each of those departments, which we haven't had before. And the idea there really is you've almost got a kind of slight Russian doll effect. So if you imagine you've got a department in the faculty with a head of department and a professional services colleague, they've got named people in professional services they can call on. At faculty level, you've got the same thing with the director of faculty operations. They've got partners from each of the professional services on the executive board. And then that's replicated at the university executive board as well. So it means I can pretty much, you know, I found out yesterday about an issue in one of my services where, you know, just a couple of people not being a single point of failure. And it's a bit like the new definition of a split second. It used to be when the light going green and the person behind you beeping their horn traffic lights. And for me, it's like now something goes wrong anywhere in the university and I suddenly get an email saying, oh, you know, do you know about this? So it's definitely opened up those lines. And the idea as well is to kind of help drive a slightly more entrepreneurial spirit, I think, within our kind of faculties than maybe colleges were able to achieve, because they can create slightly bolder pictures and visions for the future.
Yeah. I mean, all of that is really interesting and really, I mean, it's really positive as well. And I do think that, you know, it's easy to get into a kind of disaster catastrophizing mentality with the, you know, because the country, the world is in a difficult place in all sorts of ways at the moment. But I do think that, you know, whatever the future looked like, universities are at the heart of making it possible for us all to succeed in, you know, not only in those health, green and fairness dimensions, but in many others as well. So, I mean, I'm I share your positive outlook on life, Mike, and the role that your university and other universities can play in it. But what do you see, and what does Exeter see as the kind of the biggest challenges in terms of, you know, operations or the or achieving those strategic ambitions that you have coming down the track? Because there are difficult times ahead, aren't there?
Yeah, no, very much so. And you know, we're always in this situation, aren't we, where there's always some disaster lurking around the corner, you know, be it Brexit, be it the Augur review, you know, be it government's, you know, attacks on free speech or our approach to it, whatever it's going to be. I mean, you know, my answer, I think, can only be it's going to have to be in the here and now rather than the kind of slightly more strategic. I think the more strategic is, I think, is well known, but there are no easy answers. You know, we know our core unit of resource around domestic student income, you know, it's disappearing. It was disappearing at a rate of knots, and it's pretty much going to be gone in a year's time, isn't it? As inflation has got to be where we are. So what does that mean? You know, what we've seen over the last 10 years really is more and more obligations, responsibilities have been set upon universities. Expectations have never been higher on what we can do, you know, both for within our own communities, but more widely. And yet our ability to do that and our business models are going to be under severe strain. That's going to push us into, you know, more and more activity, which is, I guess, more and more commercial. So be it through, you know, further international student recruitment or other sources and that's going to become increasingly competitive, which will also change our shape. Our big focus, I think, at the moment is, you know, we obviously are, you know, we're very regretful that the sector is going into another period of industrial action. You know, it's not good for us as a community. It really makes it hard to remain collegiate and supportive. You know, we do worry deeply about the impact on our students. And, you know, when certainly going back through NSS verbatim comments in the years, you know, past when we've had this action, you sort of see the cries for help and the plaintive issues that, you know, come out from people who, you know, who really didn't enjoy that process, you know. Yeah. that's really hard. So getting over that is going to be really difficult. But, you know, we focus on, you know, respecting people's right to take the action they want to, but mitigating it as much as we can. Obviously dealing with the you know, inflationary pressures that we're all under, you know, recognizing that our staff are under them as well. You know, looking at trying to get a balanced budget for 23-24 is going to be extraordinarily difficult, isn't it? So I think we're trying to get our heads together, you know, about that now. And really, you know, looking at all the things you need to stay competitive in the 21st century. So, you know, massive investment into digital capabilities, you know, world-class facilities to support world-class researchers. They're all really expensive. You know, and if you don't invest in them, then you effectively, you kind of, you know, you become a bit of a zombie organization, don't you? You know, you they used to have those in retail, particularly, where people just literally no longer had the money to innovate, no longer had the money to start to grow and to develop and to provide a greater customer offering, and they would stagger on, but they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't end up being successful. And that's what we need to avoid. Yeah. So I think those are some of the big challenges. I mean, the you know, we've had this conversation previously around the kind of the view of universities across society, the kind of David and Goliath element of how we're treated. You know, we're seen as being part of the establishment. There's the issue around, you know, doubt for experts. I remember when I joined the sector, everyone was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. It must be brilliant working in universities. And, you know, suddenly from being in the sector, it was like, oh gosh, I've suddenly got lots of respect and people think I'm doing a good thing. And I've sort of certainly see that kind of spiral down over the past 20 years.
No cause and effect even there, though, Mike.
Well, even though, yeah, no, hopefully not. Yeah, I don't think I've single-handedly, yeah. But but definitely the kind of the sense of what we do as being, you know, adding huge value. You know, you can't help but see the transformational effect of universities. There's a, I think it's because of A High Sense of Purpose by Shapiro, a great book about HE. And he kind of talks about universities, you know, through history as almost being kind of like the place where the lights kept on. You know, if you look back to, you know, I don't know, medieval Europe. You know, the universities were literally little candles of learning and ability to kind of keep society and civilization going. And you know, certainly during austerity and, you know, during all the last 4 or 5 years and during and COVID, you know, we have continued to be, you know, creating the future professionals of the future, developing solutions to the world's challenges. So I think society as a whole needs to kind of reflect on that at the same time as expecting us to do better and do more, because, you know, that's par for the course these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, the other element of that is, of course, that which you hinted at there, is that, I mean, universities are fundamentally long-term organizations, right? You know, producing or enabling students to become graduates and then go on to have fulfilling careers takes a long time. Likewise, an awful lot of research takes many, many years of planning, preparation, implementation, trial, retrial, test, retest, you know, evidence gathering, collaboration across institutions, countries, and internationally. It takes ages, right? And you have to have a view of the world which is long term in order to, you know, to do any of these things, right? You can't approach everything like it's a fire sale, or that, you know, it's problems to be solved immediately. You just can't work on that basis. And yet there is often an assumption that we, you know, we can. And, you know, and I think that tension is quite a difficult one, because, you know, the world has not only got fed up of experts in many respects, it's got fed up of anything that lasts longer than a nanosecond. And I think that presents us with another challenge as well. Look, demonstrating long-term value is hard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the our kind of director of external engagement, you know, says, well, whenever anything's happening, it says, well, if you're explaining, you're losing. And, you know, unfortunately, universities, you know, are in the business of explaining, aren't they? You know, there is very few things in the world that are clear cut. Everything's nuanced. Everything's got an element of consideration about it. And we often don't get the time and the ability to be able to express that. You know, we saw it this week, didn't we, with some of the news headlines around the QAA, you know, and it's you know, but there isn't that time, I don't think, for people to properly reflect and think things through, and it's getting better at that as a sector, I guess, is going to be a big challenge over the next decade or so. Yeah. But I think we all recognise it, don't we? And I think we're all leaning in our own way, you know, university by university. And I think UK getting better at it as well. You know, that, yeah. I thought some of the campaigns they did around the Made in Uni were really interesting. But there is something slightly depressing about the human spirit, isn't it? Is that, you know, the thing that everybody wants to focus in on is where stuff's going wrong or where there's a potential issue or challenge, rather than the really good stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, just to finish up, Mike, the, you know, our sector is a wonderful place, right? And it's a really interesting and, you know, amazing place for all the reasons that you've articulated in the past short while. But I mean, I wonder if there's anything in your experience of higher education, weird, wonderful, strange, amusing novel that you've picked up that you could share with us that's of interest.
Well, I took me quite a long time to distill this down, because there's an awful lot of things that probably I shouldn't really mention. But so one of them, I think, is which is quite sweet, hopefully, is the tone and atmosphere within graduation ceremonies. So this year we did 53 graduation ceremonies, because we did the Gosh. 2 years before from COVID. I did 25 of them, and we sort of shared it out with the team. So it was very much on our minds over those 3 weeks. And what I love is the slightly stereotypical nature of the subject versus the tone of the graduation ceremony. So let's say, for instance, you do, law. In the law ceremony, both the families and the graduates are pretty somber and kind of pretty sensible, and they kind of cross the stage and they shake hands and they smile and everyone claps very nicely, but it's all quite kind of calm and professional. And then you get some other groups which are a bit more as you'd expect. So I was sat in our kind of drama session, and everyone in the audience was kind of absolutely pumped up. Every student crossing the stage was literally getting the Oscar. And it was just the most marvelous, joyful ceremony. And it was just incredible. It was like 90 minutes. It was just hilarious and fun and wonderful. And we were kind of, we were sort of walking off the stage afterwards, just going, you know, isn't it just fantastic that this is, you know, this can happen, and this different atmosphere. And I think it was just the commonality between the audiences and the students who were crossing over. It's such a joy, I think, to be part of those ceremonies and to see people and see the kind of output of all our work in the education space. So much talent, you know, so much energy, so much sort of commitment for the future. And, you know, I got to the end of those ceremonies and I just thought, you know, we are so lucky really to be involved in kind of the formation and the support for those individuals. And you can't help but feel optimistic about the future of the world when you see graduates of that quality who've got through, you know, some of the most terrible years anyone's ever going to face, you know. So the next time you are in a graduation ceremony, just try and guess what you think the discipline mix is gonna throw up. And you do occasionally get a few sort of random ones which are not really typical. So geography can take you by surprise sometimes, as can biology, and maths actually, that can sometimes, you know, make you change your thinking. So
Well, I think we should note with interest your observations on graduation types, but I think it's an area of study that requires further exploration, Mike, to confirm the validity of your statements. But no, I completely agree with you though about that. There is an element of magic about graduation which, you know, makes it special every single time. And I, you know, like you, I've been at hundreds of the things, and you know, I always think, oh, it takes out a huge amount of time and whatever, and there's a huge effort goes into preparing for it, but at the end of the day, those ceremonies and those people crossing the stage and the families and friends and supporters in the audience, it is such a huge event for each and every one of them, and it you can't help but being infused with the enthusiasm and the optimism, as you say, about the future of the world being in these hands.
Agreed.
Yeah. Well, listen, we need to stop there, Mike, but thank you ever so much for your time and your chat. And I've really enjoyed speaking to you and learning a bit more about you in Exeter.
I've really enjoyed it as well. Thanks for inviting me on, Paul. Good to see you.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.